Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Today, our topic is Water for Sale. Should we privatize water? With Dr. David Zetland. Welcome, David.
Thank you. Good to be here, Michael.
I'm very appreciative that you could make it with us today. Dr. Zetland received his PhD in agricultural and resource economics at the University of California in Davis. He runs a blog called aguanomics.com and has written extensively on water, the environment, and the markets. Next, I would like to welcome our special commentator, Mr. Luke McGraw. Welcome, Luke.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. I'm very happy you could be here as well.
Yeah, thank you.
Luke is a recent graduate of Curtin University in Perth, Western Australia, where he obtained his double degrees in economics and political and international relations. Luke now resides in New York City and actually did the heavy lifting in preparing the structure of this particular show. So, David, I want to start off by asking here, or by commenting that here in the West, we tend to take water for granted, but for many people in the world, they don't have this luxury. Just how bad is the situation throughout the world, and how many people do not have access to clean and safe water?
Well, Michael, there's obviously a problem with trying to get a good estimate because they don't even know how many people live in a lot of developing countries. But the numbers that I've seen are that around a billion people, 900 million people around the world lack access to safe drinking water. There's a huge problem with this definition, which comes from the United Nations, and it's connected to the Millennium Development Goals, because the UN is keeping track of people who lack access to a improved water supply. That's the word they use. Mm-hmm. So that means, do they have access to a pipe or a wellhead, for example? But the water that's coming out of that improved water supply, no matter where you are in the world, may not be safe to drink. So the number is around 900 million who lack access to an improved water supply. I would say that far more than that number lack access to safe drinking water.
Well, it's a very staggering figure. I've seen figures of 12 million deaths annually, 22 people dying every minute of every day. How accurate are these figures?
The numbers, I'm revising a book right now, and I'm kind of running across these numbers now and then inside my manuscript. And I think that the numbers that I've seen for deaths due to water contamination are around, if I remember correctly, around 3 million per year. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, your 12 million number might be absolutely correct, because you might have somebody in a village who sees a kid die of diarrhea, and that's a confirmed death from diarrhea, but then you have massive extrapolations and kind of filling in gaps that are going on with spreadsheets in different government bureaus and agencies and NGOs. And at some point, someone decides that 3 million or 12 million out of nearly 7 billion people on the planet are dying from water problems. So a lot of people are dying from water problems, and the number is in the millions, but no one really does know for sure.
Okay. Well, we can safe to say this is an incredibly large problem, and that it basically affects the poorest people in the world primarily.
Yeah, and in fact, the relative number that I like to use, I always like to use numbers that people can keep track of, but the number I was using in my book is 2.8 million people dying, most of them children, and in the U.S. every year, 2.4 million people die from all causes. So
that's
kind of a good way to scale this number.
Wow, now that's very interesting. So, well, we're coming into the end of this particular segment. This one flew right by, and so folks, please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and I'm talking with Dr. David Zetland on Water for Sale. Should we privatize water? So we'll be back in just a minute. Please stay with us right after this particular break. Thank you very much for listening. And welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market. And David Zetland, we were just talking about water for sale. Should we privatize water? And I'm going to turn this next question over to our special commentator, Mr. Luke McGraw. Go ahead, Luke.
Cool. David, we can look around and see that we have lots of safe drinking water and others have very little. It's easy to think then the solution would be for us to cut back and give them more. Are the poor actually lacking physical water, or are they lacking sufficient access to water?
Good question. I've heard of, you know, the idea that we'll just take a shorter shower and put the extra water into a nice tanker and send it off to Sudan. That's not going to happen. So the biggest issue, or the biggest thing to keep in mind about water compared to something like oil, for example, is that water is not only heavier than oil, but it's much less valuable. So shipping water pretty much anywhere is extremely expensive compared to the benefits it might bring. This means that it's very difficult to have any kind of international aid or organization sending water from somewhere like New Zealand off to somewhere like Mozambique, because it's just too expensive. So most water management issues are definitely local issues, and as you alluded to, they're not really about quantity issues. They're much more of quality issues, and that means that the people who are living in some place or have plenty of water, but it's not safe to drink, and they either lack the technology or the money or the resources to clean that water, even sometimes the information on how to clean that water up so they can drink it.
So
yeah,
can we blame nature for this lack of water that is out there?
I don't think so. On the supply side, you know, the hydrological cycle just delivers water year in and year out around the world. And humans have done some things to modify that cycle through things as simple as deforestation or diverting rivers and streams. But that's, and even global warming, and I'm sure some people don't think it's happening, but let's just say that it's one thing that could have an impact. But the biggest impact for water is, and water shortages, of course, is the other side, the demand side, and that's that we have more people who are using more water for more things. Mm-hmm. And on both sides of these, the issue really is human water management, nothing to do with nature.
Go ahead, Luke.
So for the poorest people, it's more, for them at least, it's more a larger problem of development.
If you have, you know, there's a pretty heavy-duty correlation between having money and having clean water. So, but on the other hand, I have to say that there's a significant or non-trivial number of problems with water management in rich countries. So it's much more a question of good governance and the lack of corruption than actually having a lot of money sitting around. So that's something that I pay a lot more attention to than money. It turns out, ironically, that if you look at water supply in slums in the third world, Mexico City or in Jakarta or something like that, where the poorest people do not have access to water from the pipes, or they don't have access to clean water, those people will be getting water off of trucks, and they usually are paying about 10 times the price of tap water that richer citizens in the same location are getting. So poor people have enough money to buy water, they just don't have access to it, either because of corruption not extending the water system to their area or legal problems of getting water connections in slums that don't officially exist.
Mm-hmm. So these water systems in poor countries, are they primarily?
Usually, yes. I don't have a statistic on this, but I think that that's pretty common. And there are examples that are notable of usually community-managed systems. So, in fact, I would say that the default system in most of the developing world is going to be what you'll call community-managed, so that locals are going to have a lot more oversight. The centrally managed systems, and these are both, in a sense, kind of community, but centrally managed systems are going to be the ones that are going to be in bigger cities, and they will tend to have more of a problem with governance because they are further distant from their customers.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to interrupt you, Luke, because I'm going to take a little bit of your thunder here. I know that Luke did some research and found several things that were wrong with the government sector water bureaucracies in poor countries. I'll just list five of them that he noted: lack of competition, administrative acumen, political control, perverse incentives, and lack of knowledge of best practices. Would you comment on those?
Right. I'll go through them. Let's go through them one at a time so I don't miss them, because I'm just
making a list. Okay, lack of competence.
This is a problem. Lack of competition is a problem with the public and the private sector. So you have essentially in water a monopoly, and we're not talking about agricultural water or water that's used in industrial facilities, but we're talking about drinking water. So when you have a piped network of water, that is going to usually be considered what's called a natural monopoly, because it's very difficult to build a competing network right next to it, something that we don't see with cellular service, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So a natural monopoly means that you have market power as a monopolist, and whether or not you're a government, a branch of the government, or you're a for-profit company, or you're even a community organization, you have significant power vis-a-vis your customers. And that means that if you are not going to be delivering good service, or you're going to deliver bad value for money, that your customers have few alternatives. So that's not really a public or a private weakness. It's the weakness of a monopoly.
Right. Well, actually, you answered a different question for me on that particular point, because I'm sorry, but I think you misunderstood me. I didn't pronounce it correctly, perhaps. It was lack of competence, not lack of competition. But
definitely lack of competence.
That was a definite
universal issue.
Yeah.
So a lack of competence, in especially in developing countries. I mean, we have in the developed world, we have very, very highly qualified engineers that are running water facilities. So they are very competent in doing their job. And I can talk later about how they don't necessarily they do great engineering, but not necessarily great economics. In the developing world, you're going to find that a public bureaucracy that's running a water supply is often staffed by basically cronies of politicians who are given these jobs not because they know anything about water, but because they're supposed to get state salaries. So they might actually not even go to work, or if they go to work, they don't even know what they're doing. The opposite problem, or the opposite, not problem, but the opposite effect is seen at some private water utilities that are competing in multiple markets. So they actually have the advantage of passing knowledge back and forth between operations in different locations so that best practices are promulgated around the company. And the company will do this, in a sense, to improve customer service, but they also have an interest in doing this so that when they bid for other contracts against other companies in a competitive marketplace, then they can show greater competence and win contracts. So the incentives to perform in these public bureaucracies that stay in one place are much weaker than the incentives to perform in what are called investor-owned utilities in the industry, but most people just call those private companies.
Okay. Luke, why don't you go to the next question?
Okay, sure. So I understand, David, that some of the governments in these countries are starting to recognize this fact of the benefits that comes from private companies and competition, and so they are to turn to various companies for water distribution. I know it's been a controversial issue, though, and there are many activists who oppose these steps towards privatization. On the economics of this, you've mentioned, of course, that there's millions of people are dying each year, but there's a perception that only business is out to make a quick buck. But what is it exactly that businesses bring to the table? The things that you mentioned before, knowledge of
business. The thing that most people get wrong about these privatizations, and we can talk about the famous one of Cochabamba, which is widely cited and widely misunderstood. But the thing that they get wrong is they think that some private company is going to come in and hold people to the wall and steal their wallets, and the people will have no recourse. private companies that win concessions and government bidding are not only signing contracts for performance that can be canceled and they can be ejected from the company country, but they're also being monitored on a very regular basis around anywhere in the world where there's a private entity running a water supply. And that's because water services are considered to be public utilities in the sense of the public has access to the utility. It's a very confusing word that is used even when you have private companies running the water service. So there's absolutely monitoring and recourse for failure to perform. I think maybe I missed the second half of your question.
Okay, now I was just going to also add to a comment on that. At least at the moment, or for the years and years, we've had the government running them, and people are dying, as you said. So,
yes,
I guess people sort of contracted between the two. If petitions introduced, there's going to be bad effects from that. But already for decades, there have been bad effects of the government running them.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of sad in a way that people say, you know, we shouldn't do anything about changing this situation where people are dying because the government is doing it, and that's okay. So it's just impossible for me to understand that. And in that sense, I think that some people are really having knee-jerk reactions against private companies, and it's not even that they assume that public companies do better. Or municipal water suppliers, but they assume that in the face of knowledge that they aren't doing better.
Okay, I'm going to have to interrupt you right there, David.
Benchmarks.
Sorry, David, I'm going to have to interrupt you. We're going to have to take another break. So stay with us, folks. This is Radio Free Market. We'll be back in just a minute. And welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and I'm talking with Dr. David Zetland, and we're talking about water for sale. Should we privatize water? And so far we've been talking about the actual situation that exists in the world, this problem of water and safe and clean water being available around the world. And David, you're saying that incentives are different between private firms and government departments. Am I getting that correctly?
Well, there's the main reason that there would be some difference in incentives is that there's a threat of getting thrown out of business. So if you have a private firm that's running a water service and they are not going to go out of business until the end of time, then they have a weak incentive to perform. And if you have a government firm that's doing the same thing, they have a weak incentive to perform. So, you know, what I said earlier is important. We need to find out about the competitive aspect and whether or not it's possible to replace one management team with another.
And actually, we're talking about replacing government teams, which dominate, with private. And so what role does the profit motive have that may be to the advantage of the private companies taking over water management?
They have, the easiest one is that if they do better in terms of, you know, delivering quality water and they improve the cost of service, that means they get money. So there's a profit incentive there. And that is an easier performance benchmark even inside of an organization. When you have an organization that doesn't have a performance target and it has, you know, something like a triple bottom line, or it's supposed to be socially responsible, or it's supposed to respond to stakeholders, then you end up getting 10 different versions of what we should be doing from the top to the bottom of the organization, which can be confusing for everybody, even if it's in well-meaning.
Mm-hmm. So, Luke, go ahead with the next question.
Sure. So you're saying that we get different outcomes when something is allocated through the market according to supply and demand compared to when the government rations it by a quota, for example.
Yeah. It's and the thing to remember is, you know, if we're talking about retail or tap water service, it's not really a market, is it? It's a monopoly organization that's delivering water to essentially all comers at a price schedule that's set by a regulator. So it's hard to find out what competition is except in a 5 or 7 year cycle to bid that contract and take over the service. In the day-by-day operations, what they're trying to do is make sure they deliver the water to meet performance criteria at the lowest possible cost. there's not really a market there. There is some idea of prices, there is some idea of costs, so profits are on the map, but markets and competition are hard to see. And that's where you have to have a management team that has a very strong idea of why they're there and what they're doing.
So David, this is Michael. Let me mention that what really was the genesis of this interview was me reading Frederick Segerfeld's book, Water for Sale, some many years ago, which to all our listeners, I do want to recommend this book. It's available on Amazon. It's available at Cato, cato.org. And one of the things that I remember jumped off the page back then, and this was a 2005 book, is that the concept of subsidies that tends to benefit big, wealthy farmers and industry, and the poor tend to suffer the most. And the example was given that heavy subsidies are given to farmers who are given copious supplies of water at extremely low prices. Rice is grown in the desert, where urban dwellers pay nearly 1,000 times as much for their water as farmers do. So it's pretty obvious that there are some vested interests that have lobbied the power holders to gain this benefit of water. Are these figures that Segerfeld mentions in his book, are they still holding? Are they fairly accurate?
In a way, yeah, and let me also recommend that book, which I've read and reviewed on my blog. So this is a big topic, and I know we're going to run out of time on this segment, but let me start. The first thing to keep in mind is that around the world, water is constitutionally owned by citizens, and the government assigns water rights to use the water. Those are usufruct rights, they're called. So those rights are given to farmers, they're given to industrialists, they're given to municipal water suppliers. And those rights can be very valuable, especially when there is not a lot of water available for anything, water service or running your plant or something like that. So in some ways, the value of those rights are a kind of a subsidy. Another way that those rights are or water is subsidized are just pure explicit cash subsidies, and that comes when the government uses tax money to build infrastructure for farmers or something of that nature. So that's another kind of subsidy. But the biggest difference really is that the value of water and use in a city or for someone at their household is usually much, much higher than the value of water and use for growing a crop. And the biggest problem is actually not being able to arbitrage between those different values essentially through a marketplace. So there is no market to trade water rights, and that's where you start getting huge problems, no matter who has the rights or how they've been distributed in the past.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So I would like to have you develop this particular idea of property rights related to water more in our next segment, and because this is a concept that is brand new for most people. Most people don't think of it as something that can be or should be privately owned. But we are coming into the end of this particular segment, folks, so please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and we will be back in just a couple of minutes. So stay with us, and we'll talk again in just a minute. And welcome back, everyone. So, Luke, before the break, we were talking with Dr. Zetland about water and property rights. Would you introduce, you had a specific question you wanted to discuss on that point.
Yeah, David, I wanted to get you to comment on this. Would you be able to explain to us what the tragedy of the commons is and why property rights are so important, especially when it comes to water?
Simple, what did I just say? Wrong question, wrong answer. Simple, not so simple. So the tragedy of the commons refers to what happens when you have what's called a common pool resource. And the original example was a grass field where anybody could add their sheep to the field so that each individual was getting a benefit from the sheep. But when you started adding more and more and more sheep to the commons, that ground, a limited amount of ground, there were too many sheep after a while, and the sheep ended up destroying the commons. So the tragedy was that each individual choosing an action that's rational on their from their own perspective would choose to put a sheep on there, but as a group, too many sheep would come to the commons until it was destroyed and everybody was worse off. It's a very good example to use for water, and it's typically used with what's identified by economists as a common pool resource, and that is basically something like a pool of water or an underground aquifer. And what that means in terms of the tragedy of the commons is that you might have, you know, one or two or 50, not one, you might have two or 10 or 50 or 500 different farmers, for example, who are all drawing water out of that aquifer, and each of them is deciding to take as much water as makes sense to himself, but all of them collectively are draining that aquifer so that there's not going to be as much water tomorrow as they want. Now, there's two different ways, really, to solve this problem, and they both involve a kind of a privatization. So the economic jargon for a common pool resource is that it's non-excludable, and that means it's everybody is able to get in there and get their straw in and pull water out. So in order to limit that destruction of the aquifer, you need to be able to exclude people. And essentially that means you either assign private shares in the aquifer so that each individual is not allowed to take more than that portion so that the other portions are protected and there's no race to the bottom. That's the word that they use, the expression. Or you can actually set up a kind of a club which has less formal property rights but has informal property rights so that members of the club are allowed to stay in the club as long as they follow the rules of the club. And those might be very informal, called you took some today, I'll take some tomorrow, but they can also be quite robust. And this is important. It's important to keep track of these, or not keep track of, it's important to note that both of these methods can work. And the first method of essentially privatization is associated with the economist Ronald Coase, who won the Nobel Prize for his observations on things like privatizing this commons. And the second method is associated with Lynn Ostrom, who just recently won the Nobel Prize for her work on, she's a political scientist, for her work on institutions for managing common pool resources. And ironically, she did her PhD work on groundwater in Southern California. So the point is that when you have a common pool resource, if you don't manage it wisely through one of these methods of exclusion, then it will be overexploited and destroyed so that it's not going to benefit anybody in the future.
Now, the government of Chile allowed farmers and companies to own water in the 1980s, and what were the effects of that?
I'm vaguely familiar with the Chilean example, and my impression, and I've not read anything to contradict it, is that the creation of property rights in water has led to a very robust market for water so that farmers and businesses and as well as municipalities are trading water back and forth. And what that has done is tightened up very much the distribution of water so that it tends to go to the highest value uses. That means usually cities. It means industry that is producing high value with the water, and it means agriculture that's producing high value. And that is one of the big drivers behind the shift in Chilean agriculture from what you would call low-value crops to high-value export crops, such as fruit and wine, which we get a lot of in our markets in North America.
Right. Yeah, and actually, Sigerfeld quotes that back in the 70s, the conditions for water in Chile were terrible. They were 27% of Chileans in rural water or rural areas, and 63% of urban communities had steady access to safe, clean water. And by the early 2000s, that figure was 94% and 99%, respectively. And,
right. This can be traced to two things. One is that the quantification of water volumes and water rights and the assignment of water rights meant that everybody was very interested in making sure that water was not only not wasted but also not stolen, so that if you had a water right, you were going to make sure that your neighbors weren't taking more than their water rights would allow. So that was very important. The other thing that was important is that when these markets came along, they allowed not just trading but created signals of value. And that meant that cities and other places that wanted to buy water could indicate they wanted to just by offering a price. And farmers had a good idea about how much their water was worth using it for agriculture compared to selling it to cities. So unlike the situation in places like the United States, cities in Chile had a much easier access to water for urban use. In the U.S., where there are very, very few water markets, you will have cities going begging for water that cannot get it because markets do not exist and do not know how much it costs because there are no market prices for water.
Go ahead, Luke.
There's a difference, though, isn't there, David, between privatization and market prices? So the government may get private companies to develop water infrastructure, but that doesn't then mean that you know, they can still they still then may force them to only charge a certain price.
Sure, the government can regulate prices wherever they want to. The question is, you know, when do they want to? Is that going to be efficient or helpful? So, you know, as I mentioned earlier in the show, the almost around the world, it's universally true that water is held in trust by the government. The government is assigning water rights or giving them to people that are now trading the water rights. So that structure is going to be intact. And then the trading of the water or water rights is going to depend usually on governments allowing that trade to occur. And then the prices that emerge are either going to be free market prices or they're going to be prices that are affected by government regulations.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were talking about how this has affected different water systems throughout the world. Can you give us some examples of what has happened in countries where governments have allowed private firms to start investing and distributing water? Has this generally been a good development for those lacking access to water, or has it been a bad thing?
Well, there's a lot of different market areas. So let's talk about agriculture and then talk about urban areas. In agriculture, the creation of market rights that can be and trading of market rights has been almost universally a boon for farmers. That's because farmers who have more water than they want are able to sell the water. Farmers who are keen to use more water and have higher value uses will make money with water. And it's very important to remember that sometimes you can't just get water. If there's no market, you just can't get it at all. Or if it's, even though your neighbor might want to sell it to you because there's a regulatory barrier to transferring the water. So I know that the farmers in Australia have had massive benefits from the water markets there, mostly because they have more flexibility of when to use their water. They know how much it's worth, and they can sell it to their neighbors if that's going to be beneficial to them. In cities and urban areas where you have a monopolistic water system that's supplying water, the price incentive is very important in terms of delivering service to the people that don't have water service. So if you have a for-profit company that can, and this is you know, borrowing directly from Water for Sale, this narrative, if they can extend the service area to a poor neighborhood and make money, then they will. And what I said earlier is that the poor people not only have money, but they are paying already 5 or 10 times the price of tap water to buy water from trucks. So they are definitely economically viable customers, and they are typically not going to get service with a public water provider that does not have a profit incentive to deliver that water compared to a private water provider. It's easily possible that a public water provider will provide service, but it'll be because not because of a profit incentive. It'll be because the management in the municipal water company does want to extend water. A private company has a much simpler decision: can I make money off of this customer? And that decision is almost always true. because customers are willing to pay for water, and the water service is actually quite cheap.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. What about the environmental effects then of when private companies or private firms would come into these sort of regions? Do they maybe work better for the customers, but does that then, do they have a negative good things for the environment?
Well, if they're taking water that could go into environmental use, so let's say accidentally harming the environment, that's one thing. If they're discharging wastewater that's going to pollute the environment, that's another thing. But that's not a private versus public company question. That's a question of how many property rights are there. So if there's too much water being withdrawn from a stream, for example, that's because the government has issued too many water withdrawal permits. So that's a government problem. And if wastewater is being discharged that's too dirty for that stream, then that's a government problem in terms of regulating wastewater. It really has nothing to do with private or public firms. There's lots of things we could discuss about common law and property rights to clean water, but the bottom line is that private companies can do just as good a job or just as bad a job at managing water from an environmental perspective.
That's very interesting. Sure. Did you have another question on that particular point, Luke?
No, I was going to say, I guess it sort of hinges on whether property rights are enforced and then how are they originally allocated to begin with. Because I guess if a company is allowed to pollute in a certain region and they're not punished for it, well then that's, I guess, you know, the company may only just be following a certain set of incentives that for them it's worth paying to pollute. But I guess then it comes back to, okay, well, why were they allowed to pollute or whatever region, why were they not being punished for it? You know, whose land is getting wrecked or whatever from this? So I guess, yeah, that's part of the things who...
Yeah, exactly. So the problem is that if you have, if there's, say that there's a government regulation and it says that you can have so many parts per million of, I don't know, mercury in the water discharge from your wastewater plant, and say that that number is even being followed according to by the dischargers, but it's off by a factor of 10 in terms of human health, then you'll have companies that are in compliance with the law that are actually harming people. But there's no recourse because they're following government regulations. Under a common law regime, which is different than a regulatory regime, the people who are being harmed can essentially sue and show that they're being harmed and win against the company, so whether or not it's private or public. So you can have badly written regulations. And likewise with water rights, the property rights to water, you can have too many water rights issued by the government so that you don't not only have what are called wet water rights, but also dry or paper water rights. Hmm. And these paper water rights are often issued because politicians want to give gifts to their friends, and they'll issue twice as many permits for water as exist in the stream, for example. And that is a disaster for existing holders of wet water rights because now they have some doubt as to whether or not they're going to get their water or someone else is going to take it from them.
Yeah, that's that particular example has a lot of application toward several of our shows where we discuss various aspects on monetary theory, but we'll leave that for another time.
Exactly. It's a kind of cheapening of your currency.
Yes. Well, I want to bring it over to talk about the lovely topic of sewage. You know, the management of sewage is a big problem, I'm sure, in developing countries as well, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, is it managed at all is the first thing. There's, I don't remember what the number is, but I think it's, the number is, in fact, 2 billion people around the world practice what's called open defecation. So their human waste doesn't go into any kind of collection system. And this is a problem in terms of just pollution of any kind of water or land or even roads. I've been in India and the beaches are covered with feces or, you know, you walk up and down the hills in Nepal and the paths are covered with feces. So this is essentially because it's hard to pay for infrastructure. There's also sometimes a tradition or an ignorance of how to handle human waste. I know that I have a really great example from China where I was in next to a farmer's field in a poor part of China, and there were four outhouses right next to each other. And that was because the farmers recognized the value of human waste, which they call night soil, which they use to fertilize their fields, and there was no way they were going to let some other farmer get their waste. So they were holding it in their bank account for distribution into the field as fertilizer.
Wow.
And that was kind of the opposite example of what you see in somewhere like India.
Well, I'm going to give you about a minute to answer this question, but can private firms have a positive effect here, and have they had a positive effect?
Well, it depends on the incentives you set up. So if you hire a company, if you're a city and you hire a company and you say, we're going to pay you according to the number of people you connect to the waste water network and the amount of sewage that you divert out of streets and open sewers, then that company has an incentive to set up, you know, community latrines or even household connections to collect as much human waste as possible, given the costs of doing that, which are quite high.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we are going to come into a break, and we're going to run out of time before I can let you really develop any additional questions on this fascinating and, I think, extremely important topic. We are talking about that next to water, or next to air, water and then money are probably the three things that most people, when I get right down to it, have to think about pretty much the most. And but in any case, folks, we'll be back in just a couple of minutes, so please stay with us. We'll have our final segment here on Radio Free Market with Dr. David Zetland, and we're talking about water for sale. Should we privatize water? So please stay with us. Thank you very much. And welcome back, everyone. And this is our final segment on Radio Free Market with Dr. David Zetland on water for sale. Luke, go ahead.
David, with the evident success that private enterprise has had, why do you think that the anti-privatization movement is so opposed to the involvement of commercial firms operating in the water industry? Do you think their critiques are more ideologically driven rather than anything else?
Yes. That's the short answer. It's because they typically will say, well, water is essential to life, and we can't have a private firm controlling our access to life or death kind of commodities, and it should be provided by the government, which has some kind of political accountability to people. This, of course, assumes that the government has political accountability to people, which is a big problem in developing countries.
You know, it also is a philosophical point where, to many people, profit is a dirty word, and what you're, you know, the underlying statement that you're making over and over again is that profit is a good thing. It actually.
Well, I mean, this is ridiculous. You've heard this, I've heard this, but every time there's a profit made, it's because there's been value delivered. Mm-hmm. So these companies that are delivering or making profits, whether it's Apple Computer or it's Exxon Mobil or any other company, Nestle with their bottled water, they're delivering something that people are buying voluntarily and happily, and the profit is the residual of that transaction. So for-profit companies are helping all of us, and in that sense, it's I think, really what you call a win-win situation.
Sure. The economist Harold Demsett coined the term of the Nirvana fallacy. So, wondering, would you be able to explain what that is and why we have to be so conscious of it when debating the merits of public versus private?
I've heard of it, but I think it means something like, can we have, you know, we wish for a perfect world, but we have to really deal with the world we have,
I think people sometimes will look at things and compare it to a utopia.
Right. I mean, the utopia in water is that, you know, everybody is going to have perfect water for no money, and it's just going to happen. The fact is that water is not just hard to deliver in terms of engineering, but it has a very big governance and political component because, you know, the government controls access to water supplies, and there's many, many entities out there that want to have free water from the government. So the reality is that everybody wants the water and someone's going to get it, so you need to figure out how to allocate it.
I'm going to interrupt you here because I want to ask an important question before you say water is a human right and not a commodity.
Right. So the problem is that, and this has been brought up in different versions, but someone says, well, water has been given to us by God, so it should be given to everybody for free, or we can't live without it. And a water executive said many years ago, he said, well, maybe God gave us the water, but he didn't give us the pipes.
Right.
So the problem with water is not that it's out there, but we have to get it to ourselves, to the people that need it, and that costs money. And you need to generate money to deliver the water. The hardest thing, that's the hardest thing. So if you say, I want to give everybody human rights, we have to figure out who's going to pay for it. And most of the human rights types of legislation on water, they only talk about delivering the human the water, but they don't talk about how to pay for it. And that was what was the problem of a recent resolution, the UN General Assembly on human rights for water. They made it non-binding. They said someone should just give us money to deliver this water, but they didn't create a mechanism. So
okay,
the profit motive is actually a much easier way to make sure that water gets delivered.
All right, David. Well, thank you very much. I'm going to have to interrupt you. I'm going to refer everyone to your website, aguanomics.com. And I want to thank you, Dr. David Zetlin, for being with us today.
Thank you, Michael.
You bet.
And Luke.
Thank you also, Mr. Luke McGraw, for producing this show and being our special commentator. This is Michael McKay and Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can download this and all of our shows for free. And until next week, folks, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.